Ken, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Let's start with a definition. What's hypersegregation?
Well, I think we all have a sense of what segregation is, but hypersegregation takes it to a new level, extends it more deeply into the way in which the city is laid out. It's spatial, it's historical. The Doug Massey and Jonathan Tannen at Princeton have recently written an update. Massey's article originally defined it back in 1989. And he said it was where neighborhoods were uneven, populations were uneven and isolated and concentrated and centralized and in clusters. There's a number of different sort of nuanced measures. But he looked at, he and his team have looked at a number of cities across the country and tracked over the decades the way in which these neighborhoods and these habits of settlement and decline in most cases have led to issues that the cities should be facing up to.
What about the 1920s fostered the number of variables that led to these factors producing hyper-segregation?
Sure. Well, issue of African-American neighborhoods actually goes back to the 19th century in Philadelphia, and it became much more of a large issue in the 1920s because of the sheer numbers were growing.
Migration from the South.
Migration from the South at the very time that immigration from Europe had collapsed as a result
of World War One
and policies. And so,
can we factor in a boll weevil?
Boll weevil affected the success of, or in this case, the failure of crops in the South. And so people were literally getting on the train, leaving the fields. Field to factory is the way in which it was described. And about to the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Great Migration. And it was truly a great migration. The vast majority of African Americans in the United States were Southern and rural and agricultural. And during the 19-teens and really the first half of the 20s, hundreds of thousands left, actually close to a million left in just that period, 1922-23, and went to northern cities.
And
Philadelphia,
the allure was for the potential, not what they were merely leaving, but for the opportunity that Philadelphia presented in that golden decade post-World One until the Great Depression.
Right. And Philadelphia had long been a destination for people coming from all over the world, at first from the British Isles, then Europe.
And so did the white establishment at the time initially react with curiosity, which merged into concern and then alarm?
Well, there was a well-established free African-American community even during the years of slavery. The establishment included African-Americans who were educated, who were wealthy, who had businesses, who were employers. There was this legacy of population, but it was very, very small. And so there were black businesses, there were black institutions, churches, schools. It was a place to be. And
black institutions, but not integrated.
A few were integrated, but it wasn't exactly welcomed. There was censorship of plays, of music in the 1830s and 40s. So it was a tense place, Philadelphia. It was a very unhappy place if you weren't a have, if you were a have-not, if you were a person of color. Sure, if you had some wealth, you were protected, but you weren't protected entirely. Octavius Cato was assassinated on the street on Election Day in 1871. In 1849, during Election Day, there was a riot around 6th and Naudain. It was then known as St. Mary's Street. That was lots of news stories, but it was novelized by George Lepard in a novel called The Killers. And the gang, The Killers, were the perpetrators of this. They actually took over the streets. And so if you were an African, and the tavern that was destroyed and was owned by an African-American man in a neighborhood that was largely African-American. And the killers were white and very unhappy about the rise of an African-American middle class.
That middle class was predicated in large part based on the manufacturing jobs in the city. And as we are talking about the 19th and earliest 20th century, when would you peg that heyday and then its subsequent decline?
Sure. Well, as none of us remember, but we know that the centennial in 1876, this was a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the nation, but it was actually a celebration of the industrial achievements of America, but more specifically Philadelphia. People came to watch machines work in this World's Fair, the first one that Philadelphia had in Fairmount Park, which was then only about 15 years old. So the city was exciting. Things were changing. Things were growing. It didn't appear to be that there was any end. The Civil War was a decade in the past. It looked like things would continue to get better and better for the next, two, three, four, five decades, the foreseeable future. It was only when things started to – it was a boom until World War I. And then we had a good – they had a good period. In the 20s, continued growth, but then comes the Depression, World War II. And after World War II, it wasn't going well because the city was then, affected by the automobile and the lack of popularity for urban places. It became a suburbanized nation, and Philadelphia paid for that for decades. We're only coming out now from what had started to go wrong about 100 years ago.
Of course, suburbanization then begets conversation about transportation and the car, but we'll bookmark that for another conversation. Put Philadelphia, though, in the broader context. I understand the Princeton study looked at some 40 hyper-segregated sections of cities.
Sure. Well, and Milwaukee turns out now to be the one in the worst shape. So I guess we could be pleased that we're moving in the right direction. But Philadelphia is tied with Baltimore for number 10, which puts us, behind Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Detroit. Flint is there. The measures, the sociologists look at the numbers, look at the trends, and they come up with this. And it's a ranking thing, and it's actually a wonderful measure to have. But really, what as a historian I do, and what I urge people to do, is to look on the ground, look at the stories of what makes those particular places the way they are, because in fact, Philadelphia's neighborhoods have their own characteristics.
What are some suggestions on how to go about looking at those stories?
Sure. Well, one of the neighborhoods that is undergoing a revival right now is Sharswood, north of Girard College. It's in the heart of North Philadelphia. That was the area that...
It's the biggest housing and urban development project to date from Philadelphia.
And so...
Very ambitious.
Most Philadelphians have never gone through, never taken a look at it. What can we do to help move this neighborhood into the 21st century in a way that respects the past and deals with the future in a way that doesn't... Philadelphia's a city of homes. It's a city of history. It's a city where there's a great deal of legacy. I'll give you an example. There's a recreation center around 28th and Master called Athletic Park. There's nothing right now that would tell you what happened there. In 1876, that was the site of the first National League baseball game. There
isn't a plaque, there a isn't, marker, a
there's
statue.
There's nothing telling us that. But even more significantly, a few years before that, 1867, that was the site of the first game between a black team and a white team in baseball on those fields. And
in your capacity, to what extent is there an effort to specifically cite this?
Well, I've brought it to the attention of a few folks, an organization I'm involved with, the Association for Public Art, and maybe it'll get on someone's agenda as to how to properly acknowledge this. But when I went up there to take a look at that field and I see the baseball cage, I didn't see anyone playing that particular day, but wouldn't it be great if they were to hear about their neighborhood's history and not think of it as blighted, not think of it as needing help, that in fact it has something to offer the city? Another neighborhood, the area south of South Street and north of Washington Avenue on the west side of Broad, Marian Anderson's home. And there are examples where her memory is alive. But actually, we just recently demolished a church where she learned to perform and sing. So we have to think about what we want and what we expect, because history in Philadelphia is much more, as we know and hear again and again, it's much more than the Declaration and the Constitution. We have hundreds of years of living and people here.
The Princeton study, again, is it encouraging the extent to which it finds that the trend overall in America is toward less rather than more hypersegregation?
I don't know that the trend is so important so much as understanding its structure and the inclinations of these cities and being able to advise on how to make change. What should we do about education, about policies? Without that, we're blind. So we have to thank the scholars for doing that. But the question then is, what do we do with it?
I can't wait to have you back to talk about transportation and education. Ken Finkel, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Glad to be here, Dave.
Professor Ken Finkel, professor of American Studies and Public History at Temple University, and he blogs for phillyhistory.org. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org.